A Christian convert in Afghanistan who faced the death penalty for converting from Islam has been released from prison. Abdul Rahman was released from a high-security prison outside of Kabul Monday after the case was dropped. Officials say Rahman was released because he was mentally unfit to stand trial. Hundreds of hardline Muslims protested the court's decision, chanting death to Christians while marching through the streets in northern Afghanistan. Rahman was arrested last month when officials found him with a Bible. He converted to Christianity 16 years ago while working for an international Christian group. Rahman was put on trial last week. He faced the death penalty under Afghanistan's Islamic laws. The UN is working to find a country to sponsor Rahman after he appealed for asylum. Orla Reese, the Associated Press.
Well, that's the AP report on the latest with this Afghan convert. That's just one of the subjects we'll be dealing with here in the first hour of Issues Etc. with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. In addition to the story of the Afghan convert to Christianity, we're also going to get his response to the author. Now, you've actually heard from this guy before, the author of a new book called The Jesus Papers. He's one of the guys who's involved in this lawsuit against Dan Brown, the author of The Da Vinci Code, the Holy Blood, Holy Grail book. He's one of the co-authors. Well, he's got a book called, no surprise here, The Jesus Papers, Exposing the Greatest Cover-Up in History. We'll get Dr. Montgomery's responses to how he explains things like the resurrection, how he explains who Jesus is, and how he explains a significant piece of art. He says reveals the whole cover-up, or at least reveals part of the cover-up. And then we'll also talk a little bit about something that was covered in the news recently, and that is a new satellite photo that purports to show, or at least some believe it shows, Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat. Well, Dr. Montgomery's been there and done that. We'll find out what he saw when he went to Mount Ararat and what he thinks of the latest findings. That's the first hour of Issues Etc. In the second hour of the program, Jennifer Law will join us from the Center for Bioethics and Culture. Michael Schiavo's been doing the rounds. He's written a book after the death of his wife, Terry. The book is called Terry, and we've got some excerpts from his interviews on Dateline NBC. We're going to get Jennifer to respond to some of what Michael Schiavo is saying lately about his late wife. And then we've got audio open lines for starting at 4:30. A couple of subjects I want to bring up. One is, yes, believe it or not, everyone's talking about it, but hopefully we can get a different angle on it. Immigration reform. Does God's word have anything to say about this subject? Everyone's talking about it, of course, but does God's word have anything to say about what Christians ought to believe or how they ought to behave when it comes to illegal immigration? And then, we've talked about it before. I want to talk about it again later in that hour of audio open lines. How do you account for the lack of male attendance and participation in church? We've got some alternate explanations to play for you, and we want your response as well. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is a regular guest. He is Professor Emeritus at the University in Luton in England. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States, distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, an author and editor of more than 50 books, including The Quest for Noah's Ark. Dr. Montgomery, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, let's start with the subject of this Afghan convert to Christianity. Does anything about this story, as it has unfolded, surprise you?
Not really. The judge, of course, was in an exceedingly awkward position. And the reason for this is that in Afghanistan, the official law of the country, the Constitution, includes references to the international conventions on human rights, such as the Civil and Political Covenant. And these guarantee the right to religious freedom and also the right to change your religion. Okay? Article 7 of the Afghanistan Constitution states that the country is committed to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and that allows one to change one's belief. But at the same time, the Constitution declares that if there is a conflict between Islamic law, Sharia law, and any specific legislation or any international treaties to which the country is committed, Sharia law takes precedence. Now, under Sharia law, there is the death penalty for apostasy. And therefore, if anybody changes his or her religion, in principle, that would mean that in Afghanistan, you could ignore, for heaven's sake, the international treaties that Afghanistan is committed to. You could ignore what the Constitution has to say about human rights and simply go with Sharia law. So the poor judge is caught in this in this mess. And so his approach to this was declare the defendant insane on the ground that you'd have to be crazy in order to reject Islam. And in that way, he got out of executing the fellow.
I've got to know kind of the answer to the more general question. What good is a constitution if it can be overridden by local law, in this case, Sharia law?
Well, of course, the Constitution, though, includes this overriding clause. And, you know, the Canadian Constitution, for example, has an override clause in it. I don't know if you or the listeners are aware of this, but the Canadian Constitution, the human rights law of Canada states that there is it is a bilingual country, and therefore both English and French are to be respected and employed throughout the country. Okay? Well, Quebec used the override clause to eliminate English signs in Quebec. now, this is very hard for an American to understand.
It is.
Or for that matter, for a Frenchman to understand, because one does not think, the whole idea of a constitution is to have a more fundamental law which prevents aberrations that would come about through ordinary legislation. But in these instances, of course, that's exactly what can occur. Also in Afghanistan, this is an obvious attempt to make concessions to extremists, and yet to give the impression that everything is sweetness and light. And the thing that especially worries me is that the U.S. had a great deal to do, allegedly, with cleaning up terrorism and the like in Afghanistan. Why under the sun do we permit this kind of thing?
Now, the latest story is that in Afghanistan there have been riots in the streets after the judge's verdict declaring this Abdulrahman mentally unfit. And the chant is, at least it's being reported universally over here, death to Christianity or death to Christians. Your thoughts on that?
Yes. Well, this is consistent with Islam historically. Islam has engaged in conversion by the sword, and the naivete of those who think that all religions say the same thing and that everything is sweetness and light as long as you're religious should certainly be brought to book on the basis of this kind of thing. The fact of the matter is that Islam and Christianity are mutually incompatible. They cannot both be true. The ethics are far different in the two religions. And as I pointed out in my book, Human Rights and Human Dignity, Islam violates international human rights six ways to Sunday. My goodness, the treatment of women, use of punishment, etc., the position on divorce, all of these things make it a really disreputable kind of religious position.
Do you think that Abdulrahman's case will prove to be an isolated case when it comes to either Afghanistan or, of course, a similar situation, although not identical, prevailing in the newly formed Iraq?
Well, one would hope that this creates enough offense in the international community that pressure will be brought to bear so as to limit this kind of thing. But the fact of the matter is that in Islamic countries, vast numbers of people have a very poor education. They also have no conception whatsoever of democracy, and the local imams, the religious leaders, aren't much better. And what they do is to whip these people up into the kind of action that you were describing going on after this judicial decision, and therefore it's not a very hopeful situation. Many of these countries are depressed economically. There are vast rural areas which are not touched much, even by the news media. And in those situations, of course, anybody attempting to evangelize or to convert is in an extremely dangerous position. It's possible for executions to take place without this even getting into the news.
I think that any believer who comes with me on the journey through my book is going to find the same journey that I took, i.e. they're going to ask the questions, they're going to have the insights, they're going to come to their own decisions over what I'm dealing with.
That was Michael Bijan. He is author of a new book called The Jesus Papers, The Greatest Cover-Up in History, talking this morning with Lester Holt on the Today Show. Dr. Montgomery, I'd like your response to some of the things that the author of this new book had to say. Let's hear again from Michael Bijan on the theory behind his new book.
What happened was that Jesus offered to pay the taxes. He told his people to pay the taxes. He was a leader in Israel. He put Pilate in a terrible position because the only thing the Romans required of Pilate was to keep Israel safe and to pay the taxes to Rome. He was a leader saying, pay the taxes. So what could Pilate do? He had to remove Jesus from the scene. He had to fake a crucifixion. The two of them colluded. They had to get Jesus away, but they had to make it look as though he had vanished.
All right, Dr. Montgomery, there's his theory about what really happened with the crucifixion and supposed resurrection of Jesus Christ. Your response?
Well, HarperCollins, in their advertisement for this bizarre volume, say that the author is, quote, a leading expert in the field of arcane knowledge. And I would agree with this. I mean, there is nothing like that kind of a theory. I mean, talk about arcane knowledge. It's not knowledge based upon any facts whatsoever. It's not based on any research. And when the publisher says that that the author has meticulously explored the area, and he's in some instances excavated for the first time, what has he excavated? I mean, all of this is utter nonsense. The fact that Jesus went along with Roman taxation is hardly a basis for concluding that Pilate what manufactured a resurrection of thought. I mean, this is just utter nonsense. And the fact that books like this can be published by what were reputable publishers like HarperCollins really takes one's breath away.
Okay, one of the things that the author of this book, The Jesus Papers, Michael Bijan, claims to have found is what he says is late evidence for the fact that Jesus, well, for his theory that Jesus didn't in fact die, his death was faked, the resurrection was faked, and then he was, by Pilate, kind of scurried off someplace safely just to keep the peace. One of these things he claims to have found is a painting in a church. He finds it very curious.
Very curious church. Stations of the cross around the walls of the church. Station 13, which is the crucifixion, this beautiful sunset. Station 14, traditionally they're carrying the body into the tomb, but the moon has risen. The Passover has begun. They're not going to be dealing with a dead body. It's actually showing the living body of Jesus being taken out of the tomb by his followers. Now think of the dilemma that the priest in this church had. He had obviously discovered some documents, some information which revealed the truth about the fraud involving the crucifixion. He painted it on the walls of his church for all to see.
Dr. Montgomery, your thoughts on his theory regarding this peculiar station of the cross in this French church?
Is it really the case that artistic works have a univocal interpretation? It's only possible to arrive at a single interpretation of them. I mean, it would seem to me that in light of post-impressionism, cubism, and the rest of it, most of us would have reached a point of much greater sophistication on this kind of thing. The fact of the matter is that it may well be that that one instance consisted of a metaphorical interpretation of what went on. There's no evidence whatsoever that the painter had better information on what happened to Jesus on the cross than the churches had through 2,000 years. There was a very, very important article done in the Journal of the American Medical Association back in 1986 dealing with the death of Christ. This was an article done by a medical specialist, a historian, and a theologian. It's almost book length, and the after going into tremendous detail as to what happened on the cross, the authors conclude that there is no question whatsoever but that Jesus died on the cross. So, you know, it just is breathtaking that books like this are paid attention to. But, of course, this comes in the wake of the Da Vinci Code, doesn't it? The whole idea is the Da Vinci Code sold like crazy. And so now everybody and his brother are producing pseudoscientific works along this line. Here in France, there are two or three original French novels that have just been ground out that are simply parallels to the Da Vinci Code. And this Jesus Papers thing has no more historical value than a novel or a poem.
I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. Our guest is Christian apologist and law professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Before we hear our next soundbite, Dr. Montgomery, I got to wonder, how would it hold up in court for me to walk in and say, I've found this painting in a church, that means the priest who painted it must have found a document, some evidence, and I don't know where it is, but it certainly proves that Jesus was alive when they put him into the tomb and they took him out of the tomb alive as well. There was no death, there was no resurrection. What would a judge do with that kind of testimony?
The judge would have an airline poop bag available just behind the bench, and he would bend over and throw up.
Fair enough. One wonders what the author of this book would do with paintings by Salvador Dali of Jesus crucified in the sky. I wonder what that would mean. Here's another one. The author of this book, The Jesus Papers, commenting on the existence or perhaps non-existence of Jesus himself.
The thing is, we don't even know really that he existed. We only have one external historian, Tacitus, who mentions the Jewish Messiah being executed in the time of Tiberius and Pontius Pilate. You see, that all these traditions weren't written down until the second century. There was a whole gamut, a whole range of documents, all of which had equal validity. And until the end of the second century, there was no coalescence of orthodoxy, if I can put it that way. There was no formal approach which became centralized on Rome.
Well,
of course, during this time, this is when the whole feminine component of the church got excluded too, because theologically there's absolutely no reason why there couldn't be women priests, women bishops, a woman pope.
Okay, he gave us a lot to respond to there, Dr. Montgomery. First of all, he claims that there is but one outside extra-scriptural reference to the existence of Jesus Christ. True or false?
Well, that's false, entirely so. We have, of course, Josephus. We have Pliny the Younger, and the correspondence between Pliny and Trajan, the Emperor Trajan, this sort of thing. But it's standard operating fare with people of this kind not to pay any attention to the reasons for which the New Testament documents became part of the Bible and other things didn't. The reason was that the biblical material, the New Testament material, can be associated historically with first-hand primary source witnesses to the life of Christ, namely the apostles and their close associates. The stuff that was excluded because there was no way to connect that material historically with the actual life of Jesus. And so now we have the Gnostic Gospels crew, Elaine Pagels and all of those people, saying, well, you can just take your choice. You can choose the Gospel of Thomas if you'd like. If you'd prefer that to the Gospel of John, go right ahead. The difference is, of course, these Gnostic Gospels and other materials of that kind have no historical connection whatsoever with those who actually had contact with Jesus, whereas the New Testament materials do.
Let's hear again from Michael Bygent. He's author of this new book, The Jesus Papers, speaking this morning on The Today Show.
Well, you also talk about the Jesus Papers, which your book is named after. There are documents which you say that you've seen that have described as, quote, incontrovertible evidence that Jesus was alive in 45 A.D. Have you seen these papers?
I haven't seen those specific papers.
But you call them incontrovertible evidence. That's a strong term.
Now, that's what was told to me by a theologian who had seen these papers. What I have seen are papers where Jesus is denying that he's divine. And that, I think, also pops up in the fourth gospel. You see, Jesus wasn't made divine until the Council of Nicaea in the fourth century. And until he was voted divine, there was a whole range of approaches towards the historical Jesus. But once he was made divine, it's the Nicaea, the theological Jesus took over and silenced the historical Jesus. What I'm interested in taking the readers with me in this book is to discover the historical Jesus, the deeply spiritual message that he had, and the milieu and his times, because this is very important for understanding what was going on.
Dr. Montgomery, can you set the record straight on who Jesus really was, claimed to be, and who the church believed him to be all the way back to the first century?
Well, if this gentleman's Jesus was deeply spiritual, of course, he was a person who had no understanding of himself and who was probably a deceiver and a liar, because the Jesus of the New Testament, the Jesus of the eyewitness testimony, declares that he is no less than God Almighty. He's in conversation with Philip. Philip says, "Show us the Father." And Jesus says, "Have I been so long with you, Philip, and you have not known me? He who has seen me has seen the Father." Now, no Orthodox Jew could ever make a claim like that without being a liar or a deceiver, unless he were, in fact, the God of the Old Testament. That's in the Gospel of John, is the appearance of Jesus to Thomas after the resurrection. Thomas says, "My Lord and my God," and Jesus accepts this. And if you go to the Gospel of Mark, which most people consider the earliest gospel, you have in the second chapter, at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, he's already forgiving sin. And his critics say, "Who can forgive sin but God only?" And Jesus accepts this. There is no question but what within the primary documents that have to do with Jesus' life and ministry, as reported by eyewitnesses, he is claiming to be God, and he's demonstrating this by his miracles and especially by his resurrection from the dead. So what do we say to this Jesus papers thing? Well, my goodness, the author says he's never seen the papers. But, of course, a theologian has told him about them. Does he have no conception of what hearsay is? He obviously doesn't know what heresy is, but doesn't he even know what legal hearsay is? This is absolutely worthless.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. He's professor emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He serves as distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. He's authored and edited more than 50 books, including a subject we will take up on the other side of this break, a book he wrote called The Quest for Noah's Ark. If you go to Dr. Montgomery's website, you know what you see? See a picture of a younger Dr. Montgomery, I think doctor at the time, probably standing and then at some point sitting and even taking off his crampons at the top of Mount Ararat. He's been there. He's seen it. We'll talk about Noah's Ark and the new quest for it when we come back after this break.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The joyful cry of Easter. He is risen. He is risen indeed. The death and resurrection of Jesus Christ is the good news that stands at the heart of the Christian faith. And the story of his death and resurrection stands at the center of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March. It's called He is Risen Indeed. It's a children's book, beautifully illustrated, telling the story of Jesus' death and resurrection for us sinners. You can purchase He is Risen Indeed from Concordia Publishing House, their number 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. You can also browse before you buy. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and find the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March. He is Risen Indeed. The book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Or call 1-800-325-3040.
Now take a moment to pray for another part of the world. This Global Minute focuses on people called the Newars, living in the countries of Bhutan, Nepal, and India. For over 1,500 years, the Newars have been blending Hindu rituals and Buddhist teachings. Their shrines may contain images of gods from both religions. There's one major difference, according to the Global Prayer Digest magazine. Hindus have festivals when they sacrifice animals, while the Buddhists never do. Tibetan monasteries in Nepal hold special services to pray for good rebirths of the sacrificed animals. Only a tiny percentage of the Newars are known to have embraced Christ's loving sacrifice. Pray More will hear clearly about the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Prayer is vital in expanding God's kingdom around the world. Get more involved using missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. It's partly cloudy today, an overcast that doesn't perk you up. We like to describe a good mood and a happy soul as the sun shining. Clouds, on the other hand, suggest a gloomy, overcast soul. God came to the Israelites in a thick cloud at Mount Sinai. Now think about that. God appeared to his people where they were at Mount Sinai. He did not show up someplace where they weren't, like Pike's Peak. And that he came in a cloud shows his tenderness. Since no sinner can see God's glory and live, as God told Moses in Exodus 33:20, God veiled himself in a cloud. He wanted to be close, but didn't want to destroy the people he loved. That theme carries through the Bible. That's how God led Israel through the wilderness. Exodus 40:37 says, "The cloud of the Lord was over the tabernacle by day, and fire was in the cloud by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel during all their travels." And Jesus' transfiguration, crucifixion, and ascension are all attended by clouds. Or let's say, the cloud of God. And Judgment Day, Revelation 1 verse 7, "Look, he is coming with the clouds." So if your soul is overcast today, recall this Bible truth. It's on the cloudy days that God comes closest to the people he loves. I'm Dale Meyer.
Theology is the art of making distinctions. Theology is made up of two Greek words, theos, meaning God, and logos, meaning word. So theology is words of God, both about God and from God. And that's why theology is so important.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
In 1996, on the public record, Tom Doherty, the CIA's Director for Public Liaison, categorically stated that this is the Ararat anomaly which has intrigued the United States intelligence community since 1949, when the B-29 bomber first took photographs of the anomaly on Mount Ararat.
And you believe the Mount Ararat anomaly could possibly be?
Noah's Ark. However, this is a paradigm-busting satellite image, John, because it's way too big. It's 1,015 feet long in length. Most biblical scholars think the ark was probably about 450 feet long. Also, this is not a rectangular barge. Again, most biblical scholars think the ark looked like that. Here we have a Titanic-shaped, almost modern-looking type of ship, if indeed it's a ship.
That's Professor Porter Taylor, he of the University of Richmond, talking about what he believes is evidence of, or could be evidence of, Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat. That's from an interview with CNN. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, turning our subject to the search for Noah's Ark. And we'll continue that conversation here in just a moment. By the way, there are only three spots left for Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights this summer in Strasbourg, France. Dr. Montgomery, tell us a little bit about the academy.
Well, it's the only Institute of Advanced Studies in apologetics and Christian apologetics in the world. And it's a remarkable experience. This summer we have, along with Professor Craig Parton and myself, Dr. Harry Habermas, and a certain radio communicator who has a program called Issues Etc.
No kidding.
Yeah, no kidding. And this is a two-week opportunity to study the nine central areas of Christian apologetics, history, science, medicine, across the board, philosophy, across the board, the areas where non-Christians have objections to Christian faith and the best answers to this. And it takes place in the French Rhineland, which is an ideal location. It's gone on now for 10 years, and the people who have attended this have been have raved over it. So the reason that we have these additional places this summer, we've reached our ordinary limit, but it so happened that this summer, three married couples signed up, that is to say both husband and wife, and therefore we have three rooms extra because these married couples have a very good relationship, and therefore each one has a room, you see. and that releases three more spaces. And if listeners would like to do this, this is a grand opportunity, but they're going to have to act immediately.
By the way, I spoke with a seminary student not just 3 or 4 days ago when I was traveling this weekend, who had attended, I think, a summer or two ago, the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, and rave was exactly what he did about his experience there. For more information about the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights this summer in Strasbourg, France, go to the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org. It's posted under the What's New section, issuesetc.org. Dr. Montgomery, give us a description of how you found yourself, at least according to your website, in your younger days, atop Mount Ararat.
Well, I had contact with some Seventh-day Adventists who were very interested in pursuing the question of the survival of Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat in eastern Turkey. And I went on two expeditions, which were headed by Seventh-day Adventists, and these were very nice people, but unfortunately they were vegetarians and a bit legalistic, all right? And so after that experience, I created a team myself, and in the meantime did the book entitled The Quest for Noah's Ark, which was published in the 1970s. This book is the only place where you can get all of the accounts of the survival of the boat relating to Mount Ararat. What I did was to get a hold of ancient materials. I translated some of this stuff for the first time into English, and you have from Berossus the Chaldean on up to Fernand Navarra in the 1950s who had contact with fragments of the Ark or with some kind of artifacts that related to the Ark. So this was a lot of fun, and even though the Turkish government never gave us enough of an opportunity to do the sort of excavation that would finally show that the Ark was there, we were certainly able to do a great deal to raise awareness of the importance of the issue.
Now, there are those who have claimed that a photograph taken in the late 40s by a spy, I think it was a spy plane for the U.S., of Mount Ararat shows an outcropping that could be the remains of an ancient boat. The latest, of course, are the satellite photos, perhaps a little better. They have the vantage point, a bird's eye vantage point of Mount Ararat. Have you seen these new photos and what they show of perhaps Noah's Ark?
Well, yes, but you know, the strange thing is that this gentleman who is getting so much publicity right at the moment, this Porcher Taylor, has apparently not done his homework, because in the second edition of my book, The Quest for Noah's Ark, I deal with the satellite issue. And indeed, in 1974, I gave an invitational address at the Ninth International Symposium on Remote Sensing of the Environment. This was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and was co-sponsored by the Center for Remote Sensing and the University of Michigan, the Willow Run Laboratories. And in the second edition of my book, I go into the satellite situation. The fact of the matter is there have been for, you know, now, what, 3 decades or so, satellite imagery that suggests an anomaly on the mountain in the same area as the historical records. The problem is that we haven't been able to check this out on the ground. Earlier, the reason for this was that the Turkish government was pressured by the USSR not to allow any activity of that kind, because the mountain overlooks what was the Armenian Soviet Socialist Republic and the oil fields of Erevan. And then after the end of the USSR, there's been so much trouble with the Kurds that the Turkish military, and the Turkish military controls the Turkish government, has just not allowed any serious investigations to go on in that area. So this has never been able to be confirmed. And what I don't understand is why this Taylor, this Porcher Taylor, thinks that he has suddenly discovered something that nobody has known anything about. I suspect it's because he is a professor of paralegal studies, whatever that is. Is he a lawyer? Who is this fellow anyway, I want to know?
Well, someone who says, well, okay, on your time spent on Mount Ararat, did you ever get close to the location that is alleged to be the final resting place of this great boat?
Oh, yes, very definitely. Before doing this, I had personal contact with Fanon Navarra, whose work in the 1950s resulted in the discovery of hand-tooled wood at the level of Lake Kop. That's almost at the summit. The mountain is 4,163 meters in height. It's a very high mountain and very difficult. And at the Lake Kop level, Navarra found hand-tooled wood, and this was bitumen impregnated. And, you know, the account in Genesis says that the ark was pitched. It was pitched, you know, to make it waterproof. And, I mean, why would you have hand-tooled wood at that altitude? I mean, people were certainly not engaged in the hobby of constructing mountain villages at that time or anything of that sort. We were at the same location where Navarra found this wood, and I have a little piece of this, as a matter of fact. It's my relic.
Oh, really?
Yes.
There have been illustrations throughout history, people living in and around who have visited Mount Ararat, some of them very ancient, that seem to have a remarkable correspondence to the photographic evidence that there's something up there. How long has it been thought that the boat came to rest finally on this particular mountain in this range that is usually in the ancient world thought of as Ararat?
Oh, ever since Berossus the Chaldean, and this was centuries before the Christian era. One of the complications in this is the fact that Muslims who believe in Noah and the flood have never gone with the Ararat location. They have claimed that the ark landed on a mountain called Al-Udi. And the interesting thing is that in the Quran there is the mention of Al-Udi, but that in Arabic simply means the lofty peak, and it was only later that was given as a name to a particular mountain other than Ararat. So in reality, there isn't any conflict there at all, but Muslims have traditionally, therefore, argued or claimed that the ark couldn't have landed on Ararat. And there have been, of course, other speculations, but all of the historical sightings and the historical records refer to Ararat as the location where the ark landed.
Folks, we'll open up the phone lines for the next 15 minutes of Issues, Etc., your questions and your comments on Noah's Ark and the quest for Noah's Ark with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Well, how accessible is the place where the boat is supposed to have come to rest? You mentioned its elevation. That is pretty high up there, Dr. McGill.
Oh, yes, that's 17,000 feet. It's higher than any mountain in the Western Hemisphere. The mountain is not like the Alps in that special climbing equipment would be necessary. It's a matter of endurance, essentially, to get up to that level. And because of the height, there is the oxygen problem. When I climbed to the peak, there were a couple of professional mountaineers in our group who began bleeding from the nose and ears and had to go back down simply because of the rarefied atmosphere up there. It took about almost an hour for coffee water to boil.
Wow.
So there are all sorts of problems of that kind, but in terms of being able to get up there or be able to get equipment up there, that would be perfectly possible. And, of course, it would also be possible to bring equipment in by helicopter. But as I say, this area is more or less at the intersection of Russia and Turkey and Iraq, and that's the area where there has been a great deal of political difficulty, especially the Kurds desiring to establish their own homeland, and the Turks wanting to make sure that there is no opportunity for trouble, so that they have taken the line of least resistance and have simply not allowed explorations to take place there.
One more question before we go to the phones, Dr. Montgomery. It is claimed by the latest person to take up this cause, Professor Taylor, that the image he sees in the satellite photo is more of a modern boat-like shape. He says a Titanic-like shape, much larger, he says, than the biblical account would indicate, and of a different shape than the biblical account would indicate for Noah's Ark. What do you make of this claim?
Well, that's not very encouraging, because the biblical ark was coffin-like. It was box-like. It didn't have a prow or a stern because there was no navigation problem whatsoever. Also, the size poses a bit of a problem. And you mentioned earlier those Life magazine photos in the foothills where there is a kind of boat-like shape. But that is simply an impression in the rocks and doesn't seem to have any relation to the ark at all. The key to this is to go to the area on the mountain around Lake Kopp where there have been historical sightings and where Navajo turned up the hand-tooled wood, and there excavation needs to be done. And the satellite imagery that I described in my lecture back in the 1970s and is described in the second edition of my book, that imagery associates with the same area on the mountain. Therefore, that's the key to this, and I'm not sure that the satellite imagery that our paralegal is talking about necessarily is going to be helpful.
Let's go to the phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Here is Paul calling from his car. Hi, Paul. Paul, welcome. All right, then let's talk with Ron, who calls from Town and Country. Ron, thank you for waiting. Welcome.
Hey, I was just wondering two things. Number one, why would God put the ark so high that you'd have to be a mountain climber to get down? And you may have already answered part of that question. But the second one is, does the ark have any relationship to the Ark of the Covenant as far as size or shape or symbolism? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay, Ron, thank you very much. Two questions from Ron. First of all, how would you account for it really is an extreme elevation that this boat came to rest if this is in fact the boat?
Well, we have no idea whether God likes heights or not. So it's very difficult to answer the first of the two questions. The ark obviously would have come to rest at the point where the waters receded and there was land, right? So all that says is that the ark happened to be in that location at the time the waters receded, and therefore the landing took place at that particular altitude. It could have happened in other locations, obviously. This is sort of like asking whether green is God's favorite color because the grass is green rather than red. I'm sorry to say that I am very non-speculative. I just go with what God has revealed in Scripture, and I don't worry about the other stuff. There will undoubtedly be wonderful seminars on those issues in heaven. And you can sign up at the registration desk.
The caller's other question had to do with what often confuses people who are initially exposed to this word ark in Scripture, and why this boat is called an ark, and why then later in the Old Testament we have the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, actually there isn't any connection between the two. The Ark of the Covenant was box-shaped, in other words, shaped in the same manner as the Ark of Noah, but the Ark of the Covenant was really a representation that the Israelites carried with them through the wilderness, and eventually it became a part of the Holy of Holies in the temple at Jerusalem, and it was the symbol of God's presence. Okay, now there have been some interesting questions raised as to whether the Ark of the Covenant survived. And it is said by some that the Ark of the Covenant remains in a remote monastery in Ethiopia. But I'm afraid I have not had any opportunity to check this out at all. And I just don't have the time to go to Ethiopia.
It's probably an easier climb than Ararat was, I'm sure.
Oh, definitely. No, anything is easier to climb.
Jeff calls from Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, listening on the Internet. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, did you ever get your souvenir carbon dated?
Well, I didn't get mine, but it's part of the wood that Navarra had subject to wood analysis in two places, at University of Madrid and at a wood analysis laboratory at the University of Bordeaux in France. And the results of those analyses were that the wood is at least 5,000 years old. It was impossible to carbon date it because of contamination. But the wood analysis is the sort of analysis that is done on sequoia trees and that sort of thing. And therefore, it certainly indicates that this is exceedingly old.
Here's Herman. He calls from Illinois. Herman, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues.
Thank you for taking my call. Just like to follow on what Dr. Montgomery commented on, that 5,000-year-old estimate of the age of the wood. In terms of the time span from the present back to the time of the Great Flood, if we go 2,000 years to the birth of Jesus, and then at least also on the human reproduction exponential tables of growth from 250 million people at the time of Jesus, we go back to about 2,500 years or so. That would account for the growth of the human population at the time of Jesus. And with that 5,000-year mark that was cited, would that give a time bracket on the original flood? And also, does Dr. Montgomery think there will be a time when competent researchers will be able to go to that site and do a thorough examination?
Two excellent questions. Dr. Montgomery, let's take first things first. What does this give us by way of dating the event itself?
Well, it doesn't really help us a great deal there, and the reason for that is the extraordinary number of factors involved in that sort of dating. And I've tried to stay away from that. You know, it was Archbishop Usher in the 17th century who made the big mistake of assuming that the genealogies in the Old Testament were father to son rather than major name to lesser name or whatever. And that's where we got that 4004 date for the creation, and people have tried to date the flood in terms like that or in geological terms. You can't do it biblically, and there is no reason to think that the decaying rate of radioactive elements has always remained the same. It may well be that at the time of the flood there was a serious alteration in this, and therefore you can't take the half-life of uranium as an absolute quantity. So I've stayed off of dating. I don't know what the dating is, but it's perfectly clear from the book of Genesis that the flood was universal. It was universal and is a historical event. And Jesus says himself, doesn't he, as it was in the days of Noah, so it shall be when the Son of Man comes again. So Jesus took this as a literal historical event and as a universal event.
Now, as to the second question Herman poses, do you think that there will be sometime in the future a competent research and perhaps even an expedition to go see, photograph, document, study, whatever it is, be it Noah's Ark or something else, whatever it is there on Mount Ararat?
Well, I certainly hope so. And I thought back in the 1970s that it was just a short step until that would be possible. But the years have passed, and it's been impossible to mount the kind of expedition that would do the archaeological work necessary. It's been possible for some groups to get on the mountain in the interim, but I've never been interested in that sort of thing. Incidentally, there is a book that just came out, I mean, within the last couple of years, by a ghastly, greasy religious liberal who teaches at Santa Clara University. He's a professor of religious studies at Santa Clara. And this is entitled, When the Great Abyss Opened, Classic and Contemporary Readings of Noah's Flood. And this fellow just poo-poos the whole business. Although he does cite me, he gets a good deal of his scholarly material from me, and his main comment about my activity is that in my work on the mountain, I was better stocked with Conan Boer and Moët Champagne than anybody else had been. There's no doubt about that. We were the only ones who had pâté de foie gras at an altitude of 17,000 feet.
That does not surprise me one bit. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is professor emeritus at the University of Luton in England. Never goes any place without his foie gras. And he is a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's also a distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and author and editor of more than 50 books, including The Quest for Noah's Ark. You can get this book and other books from Dr. John Warwick Montgomery by going to the website CILTPP.com. It's the website for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy, CILTPP.com, or you can call them at area code 780-461-3876, 780-461-3876. Dr. Montgomery, it's always a pleasure, and thank you for being our guest.
You're most welcome.
Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to turn from Noah's Ark to a more somber and really having heard some of this audio that I'm going to play for you on the side of the break, a very frustrating subject. Michael Schiavo's got a new book, and he's out pitching the book along with his new wife. You remember Michael Schiavo of Terry Schiavo fame, or I should say notoriety. We have some excerpts from an NBC Dateline interview that's been done. We're going to play them for Jennifer Lall of the Center for Bioethics and Culture, get her reaction and her reflections on Michael Schiavo's latest comments right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.